I'm an alcoholic. My name is Tom Brady, Jr. Hi, everybody. And by the grace of God, which has come to me through my attempts to practice the 12 steps of this blessed program, I haven't had a desire or a compulsion to drink since July 20th, 1965. And for me, this is a miracle. I want you to know before I start that I have a dual problem. As well as being an alcoholic, I'm a Southern Baptist. And you know, being a Baptist is a lot like being an alcoholic. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Once a Baptist, always a Baptist. It never changes, and I've quit trying to change it. I used to say that I suffered from two diseases, alcoholism and baptism, and by the grace of God, I was recovering from both. I want to tell you that because I have a tendency to preach. I love this program, and I like to put it across. And I was literally raised in the Baptist church. My earliest memories are in the Baptist church. From the cradle, literally. My mother just retired as hostess of one of the largest Baptist churches in North Carolina. My father is on the board of deacons now for about 60 years. He leads the choir, he teaches two Sunday school classes, and by the way, he's the most beautiful man I've ever known in my life. I tell my father now that when I grow up, I want to be like you. And it's funny, but it's not so funny, because I'm only a little over 11 years old in the life of the Spirit. And what a life. It's fantastic. I said I'm an alcoholic. Are there any other alcoholics out there? Let me see your hands. May I say you're the best-looking bunch of diseased people I've ever seen? I'm not going to talk much today about drinking. I never do. I believe what our book says, that drinking is just a symptom of alcoholism. When I speak, I usually speak about two basic things. I talk about powerlessness and I talk about power. I talk about me and I talk about God as I understand Him. Because I know deep down that my very life depends on the recognition of who is who, who's got the power and who doesn't. And I try to keep it just that simple in my talk. I'm not going to talk to you about drinking patterns because I think we lose a lot of time doing that. I could waste time today trying to match drinking patterns with some of you folks. Just like trying to match names or religion or profession or social standing or anything else. All that has nothing to do with alcoholism as I understand it. In AA we have a common bond. And one side of it is we have a common problem, and the other side of it is we have found a common solution. And I don't care if you be black, white, Baptist, Catholic, Jewish, or whatever you are. The only thing that unites you into this fellowship with me is a common problem and a common solution. And if that dog's got the problem, he can stay. Now, I wasn't, as you shall hear, an instant success at this program. And by the way, I talk about, in my talk now, I talk about feelings. I talk about what it was like inside me and what it's like inside me now. Because I can't match drinking patterns or names or anything else with you, but I have felt what you felt. And I've thought what you've thought. And I've probably done much of what you have done. And so I'm going to talk about the inner feelings, what it was like on the inside of me, not just during my drinking days, but before and now, after. Because I'm a creature of feeling. And I believe when the big book says that our feelings determine the course of our existence, it means exactly what it says. Today, I act on feelings. If I feel like I should go see a drunk, I go and see him. If I feel like I need a meeting, I go. One of the worst signs I've ever seen in an AA club room is that sign that says, think. Thinking was my worst enemy for a long time, as you also shall hear, because I was a great intellectual. I was one of those, as Chuck Chamberlain says, who was so smart, I damn near died. And every time I talk to make myself feel comfortable, I tell a couple of stories, and one of them is an all-time favorite of mine about a little boy who lived down in the Flat Pine Forest in North Carolina in a region we call the Sand Hills. And as far as you can see, there's nothing but longleaf pines and sandy soil, and it's a beautiful place. And this little kid, his name was Roger.
lived down there.
And every day, Roger would go out in the flat pine forest and he'd be playing, and the sun would begin to go down and he would realize that he was lost. And you can't shimmy up a longleaf pine to find your direction. So every day, his mom and dad would have to send out a search party to find Roger. And this went on for quite some time. And his mother got him home one day and said to him, "Roger, next time you're out there in the forest and you're lost, ask God to show you a way out, and he will." And Roger remembered this, and the next day he's out playing in the forest, and the sun begins to go down, it's dark, and he's lost again, and he realizes it. And he remembered what his mother said, and very reverently got down on his knees, and he says, "Lord, I'm lost, and I want you to show me by some sign how to get out of here. Amen." And he stood up, and he held his hand out here, and nothing happened, and he held it out here, and nothing happened, and he held it here, and nothing happened, and he held it out front, and a bird flew over and dropped one right in his hand. And Roger looked at it, shook it off, got back down on his knees, and very reverently said, "Lord, don't hand me no crap. I'm really lost." And one of the funniest things that ever happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. There was this young man that asked me to sponsor him, and when he was sober about 3 months, he got called to his regional office in Atlanta, Georgia. And he was very fearful about this. He was afraid that his past had caught up with him and they were going to fire him. And he wanted me, his sponsor, to go with him. So we got on an airplane in Charlotte and we flew down to Atlanta. And rather than firing him or giving him a hard time about anything, they were glad that he was sober and had finally gone to work and patted him on the back a little bit. And everything was good. And we were out at the airport in Atlanta, standing up at a hot dog stand having a hot dog. And I don't know about you guys from my generation, but I never have gotten used to the braless look. Doesn't mean I don't like it, I just ain't used to it. And we're standing there in the Atlanta airport, and along the hall comes the most braless woman I have ever seen in my life. And Doug and I transfixed our eyes on her, and we watched her as far as we could. That's my third problem, by the way. And when the front went by, the back was nice, and we watched it as far as we could until she was clear out of sight. And when she was out of sight, Doug turned to me and he said, "Tom, that woman sure does remind me of Alcoholics Anonymous." And I said, "How?" He said, "Man, she is self-supporting through her own contributions." I'm standing up here now and thinking back a little over 11 years. I came to AA and I was shaky and nervous. My palms were sweating and I had to go to the bathroom. And here it is, 11 years, 2 months, and 6 days later. And I'm standing before you nervous, shaky, my palms are sweaty, and I'm about to wet my pants. So pray for me. And if you can't pray for all of me, pray for one part of me, my bladder. Alcoholics Anonymous hadn't done a damn thing for my bladder. If you came here for a bladder problem, you're in the wrong place. Let's get down to it. I have today the same equipment that I had when I walked in Alcoholics Anonymous a little over 11 years ago. I have the same brain, the same arms, the same legs, the same eyes, the same ears. I almost weigh the same. And yet when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was an absolute prisoner. And I stand before you today a free man. What's changed? Why? Do you ever ask yourself why? What's different? What has this program got that can change my weaknesses into my strengths, my liabilities into my assets? What's the difference? What has changed? And we'll talk about that some too. But let's get down to those feelings I was talking about. I am an ultra-sensitive human being. I don't know an alcoholic who is not an ultra-sensitive human being. I could never take praise. I could never take criticism. When I hear a piece of music today, I break out in wall-to-wall chill bumps, and I'm liable to start crying if it's a pretty piece of music, and I can't explain to you why. Every time I hear an Al-Anon or an Alateen talk, I got to pull out my handkerchief. They may not say anything, but it gets me, and it gets me in a place where the whole program has gotten me, where I think is the heart. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a mind trip. It's not a mind trip at all. The smart people have a hard time with this program. It is very much a heart trip. It deals very much with the insides. I was one of those guys who was so sensitive, I walked around with my feelings sticking out 50 yards in all directions, and God help you if you stepped on them. But you know a funny thing about me? If no one stepped on those feelings, I'd go find someone to hurt me. Sensitive. And as far back as I can remember in my life, I was afraid. I read a book once written by a psychologist in which he listed 206 different phobias or fears. And true alcoholic, when I got to the end of the list, I'd had them all. But I said, no, there's one fear that he left out. Fear number 207. This fear that Bill Wilson called the fear of impending doom. This fear that every alcoholic on the face of God's earth has felt at one time or the other in his life and probably will feel again. And it goes like this. Oh, my God. I don't know what's going to happen to me. I don't know where. I don't know who's going to do it or why. But something's going to happen to me, and it's going to be bad. Or as a friend of mine from California says, it's the feeling that all things being equal, somehow, today, I'm going to get screwed. And I think every alcoholic has felt that fear. Now, I want you to know I had a lot to be sensitive about. I was the ugliest baby you ever saw. My own mother wouldn't take me out of the house for the first 6 weeks I was on earth. She said she never saw an ugly baby until I came along. My own mother. And I've seen my pictures. My mama wasn't lying. I was ugly. I was red in all the wrong places and white in all the wrong places. God, I was a mess. And as I grew up, it didn't improve much. I grew this great shock of platinum white hair. And everybody called me Puddinhead and Cotton Top and things like that. And I had freckles. I had freckles from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet. I had freckles where you ain't supposed to have freckles. But I had them there. And I was skinny. I was so skinny when I turned sideways, my shoulder blades protruded like handlebars on a tricycle. And that wasn't enough for my mama. She always made me wear knickers, brown corduroy knickers. And it wasn't enough that I swished when I walked, you know. It was that my legs were that big and the holes in the knickers were that big and I was forever pulling up them damn knickers. And when I went to church, she made me wear a little blue cap on the back of my head. God, how I hated that blue cap. Oh, I tell her today, Mom, you made me wear a yarmulke and I ain't even Jewish. I couldn't go nowhere without that beanie. And that didn't help things, and I was pretty self-conscious about that. But I used to figure to myself, if I can only get rid of these freckles, everything's going to be all right. And I did. Along about the age of 12 or 13, they were replaced with the most beautiful set of pimples you ever saw in your life. And I had pimples where you ain't supposed to have pimples, too. I couldn't have plain old acne. And my mom and daddy always told me if you did certain things, you'd have pimples on your face. And I used to say that I didn't do any of those things. The hell I didn't. I had a natural talent for it. Ambidextrous. I lived in fantasy land a hell of a long time before Disney built the place. And that made me self-conscious. As much as I denied what I was doing when I walked down the street, all people had to do was look at my face and they knew what I was doing. There's a story about a little kid whose mama caught him doing that. She said, "Son, if you keep on doing that, don't you know you'll go blind?" He said, "Mama, it feels so good. Can I just keep on till I have to have strong glasses? I wear them." Psychologist told me one time it was a good release for tension, and boy, I was tense for a hell of a long time. And for a long time, I couldn't talk about that. But there is a line in the book on page 70 that says, "Now about sex, period." And I could give you 3 hours on sex. But I better not. So I was sensitive. And I was a romantic. Are you a romantic, an idealist? I think all alcoholics are. I was always sitting around wondering what I was going to be when I grew up. Always dreaming. I never was satisfied with what I was. I always wanted to be something else. I never was satisfied with where I was. I always wanted to be someplace else. I love atmosphere. Did you love atmosphere? And I loved women. Beautiful women. Mediocre women. Ugly women. Atrocious women. Yeah, fat ones too. And I used to say to my wife when I was drunk, "How would you like to be married to a Baptist preacher who practiced medicine and law on the side?" I never was satisfied with what I was. And I was fearful, and I was an idealist. I came into the world, it seems, with an idea about how everything ought to be. How beautiful it ought to be, and it wasn't. I wasn't. You weren't. The world wasn't. Nothing was in place. Everything was out of kilter. And I had to find some way to live comfortably in reality. Some way. And I became what people call a perfectionist. I became very early the most disgustingly perfect kid you have ever seen in your life. Everything I ever did, I went into it with a vengeance. And I was going to do it quicker and better than anybody else had ever done it. I always had to be in first place. I always had to have the spotlight. Second place wasn't good enough. I lived only for your approval and your pats on the back. And as long as I was getting that, I was comfortable. But there's another side to perfection. And by the way, when I talk about perfection at AA meetings, some people kind of shake their heads. And like they're not. If you're an alcoholic, you're a perfectionist. And let me prove it to you. How long can you sit and look at a crooked picture before you have to straighten it up? Come on. That's a perfectionist. In my own life, if I wasn't at the top, I was automatically at the bottom. If I wasn't the best, I was the worst. That's the way a perfectionist lives, like a yo-yo. There's no life in between. I was always too happy or too sad. And even when I did things perfect and pleased everybody, one person was never satisfied. Me. Never, ever satisfied. I was hung up for years on what I ought to be, what I was supposed to be. And today I found out in Alcoholics Anonymous, after a long time in this program, that by being what I am becoming what I always thought I ought to be. And it doesn't work the other way. But I wasn't what I ought to be. I wasn't what I was supposed to be, and I began to dislike me. And after a while, I began to hate me. I have never met an alcoholic in Alcoholics Anonymous when he first comes in the door who isn't carrying a tremendous load of self-hate. Ask him what he thinks about himself, and you'll get something like, "I'm the sorriest SOB in the world." Not sorrier, not sorry, but sorriest. That's the way a perfectionist thinks. Best, worst, either or. Always in opposites, leaving out all of life in between. When I was in the Baptist Church, as an example of perfection, there's a group of boys in the Southern Baptist Church called the Royal Ambassadors for Christ. And the highest rank in that outfit was Ambassador Plenipotentiary. And I couldn't even pronounce the word, but I was one quicker than anybody ever been one before. And they put me up in front of the church, and they put the spotlight on me, and they had me recite memory verses. And they patted me on the back and told me just how wonderful I was. And all the mothers told their little boys, "Why aren't you like Tommy?" God help them if they were. But I had the facade. I began to pretend to be something that I wasn't. And the biggest lie that I ever committed was this pretense. And there was always a part of me that knew that I was pretending. I think inside every human being is a thing that I call a knower. And on the outside, I was a liar. But the knower knows when the liar is lying. And it was always that way, drunk or sober. And I became, at 17 years of age, a musician. I borrowed a bass fiddle from the high school band director. I put a new G-string on it. I practiced solid for 2 weeks. I liked to drive my mom and dad crazy plunking on that damn bull fiddle. But at the end of 2 weeks, I was playing with a college dance band at 17 years of age. That's what a perfectionist will do. But I was still afraid. And I was still self-conscious. And there's some spin-offs from perfection. I knew I wasn't what I ought to be, so I hated me. I knew you weren't what you ought to be, so I hated you. And I knew the world wasn't what it ought to be, and I hated the world. Later on in life, I became an intellectual. I never made below an A in school until I was 15 years old. And that's when I had my first drink, and school was out, literally. When I graduated from college, I graduated cum laude with a 3.94 average out of a possible 4. Was elected to who's who among students in American universities and colleges my junior and senior year. Was a member of every honor society they had. Was a soloist with the college choir. Sang with the college alumni quartet. Had my picture in the newspaper more times than I could count. Beautiful picture. The facade, the outside, the liar. I had so many scholarships, when I graduated college, they owed me $16. I can take you to my home and I can show you the pictures of myself in my college annual. Not just a little bitty picture, a half page. And up above it says, "Who's who?" And down below, it gives you my pedigree. And I read that pedigree sometimes and I say, "Damn, I'm smart." But then I remember the picture. And the first year when they took the picture, I was so hungover, I was about to shake out of the chair. And the second year, I was so drunk, I was about to fall out of the chair. I wasn't what I appeared to be, and I knew it. And I hated me more. When I was 15 years old, I was on a high school singing trip in Greensboro, North Carolina, at the King Cotton Hotel, on the 14th floor. And I was with some older fellas who were more experienced in life than I. They were 16 and 17. And we don't have open bars in North Carolina. You have to get it from a state store. And you can get bootleg. And they sent out a cab driver. And the cab driver bought in a pint of cream of Kentucky. I didn't know what to do with that stuff. One of the older guys says, "I'll show you." And he poured me a water glass full of this magic elixir. And he says, "Drink this and then drink a water glass full of water right behind it and you'll feel good." And I drank it. And boy, did I feel good. And I drank another water glass full. And I felt better. And I wasn't afraid anymore. And you were okay, and the world was okay, and the room was okay, and everything was warm and nice, and it didn't make a damn what I ought to be anymore. For the first time in my life, I experienced freedom, but not through sobriety. And that's the reason I believe alcohol is so powerful. We say it's cunning, baffling, powerful. It's powerful for me because it created the illusion of freedom. Everything's okay. For the first time in 15 years, your pimples don't matter. And I had found an answer. And those older guys got sick and they vomited and they passed out. And when all of them were out, I called the cab driver and sent him back and got me a pint of cream of Kentucky. That was one of the most memorable events of my entire life. I shall never forget it. I had found the answer. Not a problem, an answer. But the trouble with that answer was it only seemed to change reality. When the magic elixir wore off, reality was the same, and I was the same. And that meant more of that magic elixir, and more to keep changing reality and keep changing it. And it became a problem rather than an answer. As well as these other things I've talked about, I've got to tell you that after I found this magic elixir, I became very insane. Insane people have all one thing in common. They all believe in a lie. Go in the back ward of your state mental hospital and you'll see some guy balled up in the corner in the fetal position and he's giggling, laughing, singing, and talking to himself because he thinks there's no one else to talk to. And we look at him and we say, there's someone else to talk to. That's a lie. He must be crazy. And we meet the guy who's developed a system to break the bank out in Las Vegas, and he thinks somebody's chasing him to get his system away. And we look at him and say, he's got no system. Nobody's chasing him trying to get his system. That's a lie. He must be crazy. And what about Tom? Who, no matter how many times I had been in hospitals, jails, psychiatric wards, drying out places, religious homes for alcoholics. No matter how many times I'd knelt over the porcelain throne saying my morning prayer, crawling in on my belly and making that quick decision about which end to put on first, could still tell myself the alcoholic's lie. This time, it's going to be different. This time, if I just handle it right, I'm going to be able to drink like everybody else. The alcoholic obsession, the alcoholic lie. I got a friend down in North Carolina who talks about alcoholic insanity. He says you can take a normal man and a schizophrenic and an alcoholic and put them in this room today. And when they go out that middle door after the meeting, there's a guy outside with a baseball bat and he lets them have it right upside the head. Said the normal man will never go through that middle door again. He'll pick another door. Said the schizophrenic will go through the door one more time, you know, just to see if it was real. And he gets belted with reality one more time and he won't go through the door. He said, but what about the alcoholic? He said he'll go through that door time after time after time after time after time. And one day if he gets there and the man with the bat's not there, he'll sit down and wait for him. It's true of me. I didn't like myself. And I kept doing the thing that was killing me. Another friend of mine says, every dog and every cat, if you feed them something or give them something to drink that makes them sick, has the basic intelligence to recognize that thing the next time you try to give it to them and the basic will to say no to it. And he said, I, as an alcoholic, did not have that intelligence and did not have that will. As a matter of fact, I kept taking the thing that was killing me. And one thing I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is how to recognize what's good for me and say yes to it and what's bad for me and say no to it most of the time. Not all the time. Because some of those no-nos are beautiful. And some of those no-nos are pleasureful. And I'm a creature of feeling. And I always, if I felt good, I wanted to feel better. And if I felt better, I wanted to feel best. And if there was something beyond best, I was going for that. The ultimate in feeling is what I wanted. The only time I ever got that feeling was on pot one time. And I was smoking that pot, and all I could do was lay back on the bed and just grin. I couldn't move nothing. And it was very inappropriate, because I had one of the most beautiful redheads with me you ever saw. And me laying there grinning, you know. That was one time I damn well wasn't satisfied with what I was and where I was. I couldn't move. My wife told me a story about a cousin of hers one time to illustrate alcoholic insanity, too. That he was out in the backyard one day when he was a boy, and he was arguing with this little kid across the fence. And they both got very mad. And he ran into his back porch, and he got a ball-peen hammer. And he came back outdoors with that ball-peen hammer, and he yelled across the fence at that other kid, said, "If you don't do what I want you to do and say what I want you to say, I'm going to hit you on the head with this hammer, just like this." Like he killed himself. And I thought to myself when she told me that, "Damn, that's dumb." And then I got thinking about me. I lived my whole life that way. I said to the world, "I'll show you, I'll kill me, just like this." Time and again I did it. Think about it. And yet we sit around our discussion tables in AA meetings, and when you mention insanity, somebody covers up. "Not me." The hell it ain't you. Yeah, that's crazy. By the time I was 23 years old, I had had over 1,000 stitches taken in my face alone as a result of drinking. I have scars all over my body. I was never supposed to drive a car in the state of North Carolina again. I was on 5 years probation with a 2-year active sentence hanging over my head. I had been in psycho wards, religious homes for alcoholics. Jail, the Wake County Jail in Raleigh, North Carolina, was my second home, and I never want to forget the Wake County Jail. One of my worst defects of character was I forgot what it was like. Let me tell you about the Wake County Jail. I woke up in there more times than I care to remember. Always in the bullpen, always with the cotton mouth. You can't describe that to anybody who's not an alcoholic. How your tongue's dry and wet at the same time, but it ain't really a tongue, it's a piece of cotton. And it tastes bad. No cigarettes, in the bullpen, tromping up and down, wondering why I got locked up. And the thing I never want to forget is the breakfast in the Wake County Jail. They'd come in with a tin plate and a cup full of coffee, and one of them 10 cups. And you try to put that 10 cup to your mouth and it'd stick to your lip. And on that tin plate was a pile of yellow powdered eggs and a couple of winnies lying in grease and burnt. That was your sausage, I guess. But the thing I'll never forget in the Wake County Jail, and this is a southern jail, was the grits. Grits been laying on that plate in that grease so long, you stick your fork in, the whole damn pile came up. It was like eating an ice cream cone. And one reason I stay sober today is I don't want no more of them grits. And I want to tell you about the psycho ward, because I don't want to forget that. I enjoyed being in the psycho ward. I committed myself to the psycho ward at the Veterans Hospital, and I'm one of the few people who excelled at being crazy. In this hospital, on the top of the hospital, as usual, there were 4 wards, 9B, 9A, 10B, and 10A. And you graduated from one to the other as you got weller. I didn't stay in 9B but 2 days. I stayed in 9A 2 weeks, and I skipped 10B and went straight to 10A. And I used to stand up there on that porch looking through that wire, looking out at them, and saying, "Ha ha, you can't get me now." Who the hell was the prisoner? Who was it? And I liked it. Because all I had to do was look a little funny, and one of them nurses come running with that dripping Demerol needle and pop me in the butt and make me feel good and change reality again. They gave me uppers, they gave me downers, they gave me Minnesota multiphasic personality inventory and the Rorschach test. I took so many Rorschach tests, I don't ever want to even look at another Rorschach test. I had a psychiatrist who hung on my every word. I loved that. I loved it. He gave me a pencil, a piece of paper, and asked me to write down my dreams. And I wrote down some doozies. I lied. I couldn't even tell the truth about my dreams. You see, they weren't good enough. I took occupational therapy. Everybody else wove rugs and wove baskets, and I made paladin gun and holster sets. And I played ping pong with a schizophrenic Cherokee Indian who became a great friend of mine. 10-12 hours a day I played ping pong with this man. He never changed his expression. It was always the same. And my doctor used to say, "Tom, why do you play ping pong with him? One of these days he's apt to break out of that spell he's in, and he might be dangerous, and you're the closest one to him." I didn't care. You know why I kept playing ping pong with him? Because I couldn't beat him. And I had to be on top. They came in one day, and I don't want to forget this, with a box. And they opened up that box, and they took out a frame, and they put it on a desk. And in that box was every kind of paper doll you ever saw in your life. And they said, "Tom, we want you to take these paper dolls and put them in this frame just like you want them. And when you finish, tell us a story about it." And I thought, this is a silly thing for an intellectual to be doing. But you know, I enjoyed playing with them paper dolls more than anything I'd ever done in my life. I put every paper doll where I wanted it, and it stayed put. It did not talk back. It did not argue. I put every piece of paper furniture where I wanted it. I even made up the story. I really was God in that situation, and I liked it. And I got out of that psycho ward one night, and I went out and got drunk, and I came back, and I was going to get me a Cherokee Indian. I'd show him. I'll kill me. And I threw him out of his bed in the psycho ward, and the next day, I'm one of the few people to ever get thrown out of a psychiatric ward, but I was thrown out. And I went to a religious home for alcoholics. And God loved the man who ran it. And right away I reached the top. They had preaching on Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, Sunday morning, and Sunday night. And before 2 weeks was out, guess who was preaching? And guess who was running the front office? And guess who was counseling those poor drunks coming in there? And I started reading the J.B. Phillips version of the New Testament, and I read the Apostle Paul till I thought I was the Apostle Paul. I'd walk across the cow pasture and have spiritual experience after spiritual experience. I know now they were hallucinations. But I reached the top quickly, and I became convinced I should become a Baptist minister. How about that? Undo all the bad you've ever done by doing good. It didn't work. I didn't get 2 miles from that place before I was drunk. We had a gospel quartet down there. We called ourselves the Four Roses. When one of us was drunk, we sang as a trio, the Three Feathers. And I don't want to stay too much in that. We got to get on. At 23, the intellectual royal ambassador for Christ came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did a quick take. And there was a guy standing up front, and he had the spotlight on him. And everybody was listening to him. And he had a blue book in front of him. And on this side was written 12 steps, and on this side 12 traditions. And the great mind went to work. And the great mind said, "All you got to do is memorize this and this and this, and they'll put you up front and put the spotlight on you and listen to you. You'll be president of this damn outfit in 3 months." And do you know, I memorized the book. I can quote large parts of this book to you now, but I don't have to anymore. I'm free of that. And I learned those steps backwards and forwards. And they did put me up front, and they listened to me, and I delivered some of the windiest and longest dissertations on philosophy and theology and various other kinds of bullshit you ever heard in your life. The only trouble was, when I wasn't talking to you and you weren't listening to me, I was out drunk somewhere. People say go to meetings. I went to 8 meetings a week sometime. Get drunk on the way there, get drunk on the way home. And I couldn't understand it. I knew everything there was to know. But I couldn't find the switch. I couldn't turn sobriety on and off the way I wanted to do it. And for the next 7 years, I did the worst drinking I ever did in my entire life. I'd get drunk, I'd get sick, I'd come back to AA. Every time I'd rejoin AA, and in the South we give out poker chips. You get a white chip when you first join, and a red chip when you're sober 3 months, and so on. And every time I'd go up to pick up a white chip, I'd make a speech. And you know what I'd say? In essence, this time it's going to be different. I have learned to live like a man. I'll never be that weak again. The next time I'd pick up one, I'd make another speech. Same substance. Phony. There was an old-timer in AA at this time that I hated. I went to one of those groups where everybody had a seat. You ever been to one of those groups? You don't dare sit in that seat. And over on the left-hand side, leaning up against the wall, was a fellow named Barney. Beautiful man, over 20 years sobriety now. And next to him was Jim S., and next to him was Freeman, and then there was Martha. And I could go all the way around the room and tell you where they sit. But over on the right-hand side, in the second row, the second chair from the wall, sat the meanest man that God ever made, Grumpy. And I didn't like Grumpy. I hated Grumpy. Because Grumpy always told me the truth. Grumpy'd say things to me like, boy. He always pointed his finger at me and called me boy. He'd say, boy, how come you always running around looking for God? He ain't lost. He'd say, boy, you don't think your way into good living. You live your way into good thinking. I think to myself, shut up, you dumb old son of a bitch. I don't want to hear you anymore. I'm smarter than you are. Said to me one time, boy, the good Lord gave you two ears and one mouth. Does that mean a damn thing to you? Then I'd go into those meetings on Tuesday night, and I'd been out of the college where I was, sitting in the Buddhist position, reading The Imitation of Christ and Aristotle and Martin Buber and Paul Tillich, you name it, and I read it. Looking for God, just like he said I was, and God wasn't lost. I used to sit in the Buddhist position waiting for my spiritual awakening to happen. You know, I figured if God could knock Paul off a jackass and light up a bush for Moses, the least he could do for me was one lightning bolt. And God somehow never understood just how unique I was. That I had to have a spotlight experience. A top-of-the-heap experience. And you know, I go to those meetings loaded for bear. Did you ever go to those meetings with such heavy knowledge to lay on the troops that your knuckles was white and your hands were sweating? Don't lie now. A pretty good session of can you top this, and you know it. And that's all right. And I'd fall in this meeting with this heavy knowledge, you know. And somehow they always got to me last. Everybody say the same thing every Tuesday night. Same thing. I could tell you what Grumpy's going to say. And Grumpy would get his turn, you know, and he'd rattle his chains a little bit, and he'd pull his nose, and he'd run his hand through his hair. And he'd rattle his chains and pull his nose and run his hand through his hair. And rattle his chains and pull his nose and run his hand through his hair. Say the same thing every Tuesday night. Now, my wife laughs at me now, because I walk around the house rattling my chains and pulling my nose. Man, been sober 29 years. There got to be something to it. But anyhow, I'd fall in with this heavy knowledge, and they always got to me last, you know, and it was like the meeting was over when it came my turn. And I'd say, Martin Buber said so-and-so, and Paul Tillich said so-and-so. And Grumpy'd look around and say, shut up, dummy. And I wanted a red chip, that 90-day chip, so bad that when everybody else would go across the hall to have coffee, I've been up to the chip box and stolen red chips. I was tired of being nobody. I wanted to be somebody in this fellowship. God, how crazy I was. It's just coming to me. 7 years with all of the spiritual tools that any human being can need to stay sober. And I was worse off than I ever was.
There's a story told about these two identical twin boys. And one of them was an eternal optimist and the other was an eternal pessimist. And their mom and dad took them to a world-famous psychiatrist and told him what the problem was. And he said, leave him with me a week or two. I'll see what I can do. And he took the little pessimist and he locked him up in a huge room filled with every kind of toy that any little boy could ever want. There were rocking horses and trains and baseball bats and basketballs and everything he could want. And he locked him up in that room and left him. And he took the little optimist down the hall to another room and opened the door. And in this room was horse manure piled this deep. And he took the little optimist and shoved him in the door and locked it. And he left them both there a week. And he came back to the room where he'd left the little pessimist and he heard weeping and wailing. And I love that biblical term, gnashing of teeth. And he ran to the door and he threw it open. And here sits this little kid in the midst of all this world full of toys just crying his heart out. And he said, son, what's the matter? He said, that's a nice train, but you got to plug it in to make it go. He said, I like that truck, but you got to wind it up before it run across the floor. He said, that's a nice rocky horse, but you have to rock back and forth or it won't do anything. And I'm so sad. And the doctor threw up his hands and walked out. He went down the hallway, he left that little optimist and that horse manure. And he approached that door, he heard the darndest shuffling he'd ever heard in his life. And he ran to the door and he threw it open and the little boy standing there doing this. He said, son, what are you doing? He said, man, with all this in here, there's got to be a pony somewhere, and I'm going to find him. Now, for 7 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I sat in the midst of every spiritual tool I could need for sobriety, and I stayed drunk because I didn't want to plug it in or wind it up or rock and make it go. I did not yet know that action is the magic word. But today I know there's a pony here somewhere, baby, and I'm going to find it. Because I'm a happy man. And I'm free. I went on until I was 30 years old. Grumpy, I used to call when I was drunk. I got to tell you this. I never called him before I took a drink, always after. And usually after the test pattern went out on TV. And I was usually crying to Grumpy because somebody else's story was better than mine. Are you ready for that? Called Grumpy one night drunk. He said, boy, don't you ever call me again drunk. He said, matter of fact, don't you ever call me again. He said, if you want to get sober, you know where we meet. And don't call me to come get you. You can walk. And he said, as far as I'm concerned, boy, I don't care if you ever get sober. Boom. He hung down the telephone. And that hurt my feelings. But in retrospect, that is one of the most loving things that any human being ever did for me in my entire life. At 30 years of age, I came to a place that we call bottom. And bottom is the end result, for alcoholic or non-alcoholic, of self-will run riot. There is no other result. And at bottom, I found a new feeling, the new bottom feeling, the feeling of despair. I couldn't drink and I couldn't quit. And I knew it. And I said those famous alcoholic words over and over. What's the use anyway? What's the use? Little did I know, that was the end of the beginning. I gave up, and I didn't even know it. I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know anywhere else to go. You know how I got there? I walked. I was never supposed to drive again. And I sat on the back row. And I got there late, and I left early. And I said nothing to anyone. A couple or 3 weeks passed. I began to notice this one man in the group. And I wanted to stay sober. I didn't think I could, because I had tried AA. And I asked this man, Harry, would you be my sponsor? And you know what he said to me. He said, boy, He said, I've heard about you. He said, they say you're crazy. They say if you ever come my way, for me to go the other way. But he had the grace of God in him, and he said, yes, I'll sponsor you on one condition. And I said, what's that, Harry? He said, we do it my way. And I said, yes, sir. And he said, first off, I want you to go to meetings early. I want you to go in and shake everybody's hand and ask them how they're doing. And I said, Harry, I don't want to go early. I don't want to shake anybody's hand, and I don't care how they're doing. And why do I have to do that? And I was getting a constant refrain from my sponsor, and it went this way. Don't ask me why, Tom. Just do it. And I started going to meetings early. It'd been a long time since I looked anybody in the eyes. I looked at shoe tops. I looked that way, that way, that way. Anywhere to keep them looking at anybody because they could see in me and they knew what I was. It was almost like internal pimples. And I started going to those meetings early and I was shaking hands and I was looking at shoe tops. And after a few weeks, I was looking at ankles and chins and knees and thighs and hips. I saw some damn nice hips. And waist and got up to the chest. Woo. Shoulders, neck, head, and finally magic. After a few weeks, I was looking them in the eye. And I was saying, hi, I'm Tom. How are you doing? And I did care how they felt. And I was glad to be there. And I got to meetings earlier and earlier, and I started making the coffee. And I put out the ashtrays. And I washed the cups, and I emptied the ashtrays. Nobody was going to beat me at emptying them damn ashtrays. And I went on 12-step call with my sponsor, and I went in there all holy, and I said, what do I say, Harry? He says, you don't know nothing. You don't say nothing. Sit down and shut up. I said, when do I get to talk, Harry? He said, I'll tell you when, and I'll also tell you when to shut up. And he did quite often. God bless his heart. He said, call me 24 hours a day if you need me. I said, uh-huh. I don't believe that. So I tried him. Not only did he get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, his wife got up, made a pot of coffee, held my hand, cuddled me, loved me, cared for me, over and over and over again. He meant what he said. And it was in his eyes. And I began to look different because my wife said to me, after about 3 months sobriety, I wanted to go to a retreat. And she said, we don't have no money. And she had a weird habit of hiding money away to buy groceries with. Well, I wanted to go to this retreat, and it cost $20, and I didn't have $20. And she looked at me, and she walked to the hall closet, and up underneath all those towels, she reached in and pulled out a $20 bill. And she said some of the most marvelous words I'd ever heard in my life. Honey, you're different. I think you're going to make it. Go to that retreat. And I went. The people in North Carolina took bets on me. My sponsor was bet I would never stay sober a year. And I was with him, by God, when he collected. We're miracles. We forget. If you're an alcoholic and you've been sober one day, you are a walking miracle. Because it ain't logical for you to be sober. It is logical for you to be drunk. But thank God we tapped a power who knows no logic. And it's fantastic. And I started staying sober and I started getting different feelings. I was sitting at the college one day where I worked, and I was eating my lunch. And all of a sudden, the feeling attacked me. And it said, hey, Tom, you haven't wanted a drink for over 3 months. And I broke out in chill bumps, and I cried. What else can you do? And I thank God. And after being sober a year, I was up at a retreat.
and some lady was up on the roster making what I guess was a pretty good AA talk, but I didn't hear a word she said. I was sitting on the back row holding on to my chair, humming "Love Lifted Me." At the state conference, I was doing the same thing. I had to hold on to the chair, literally. I'm not putting you on. Because I wanted to jump up in that chair and say, "I am free. Thank God I'm free." Then I went to another retreat. And I went into a small chapel. And I don't normally go in chapels, but I went in this one. And they had a picture window up behind the sanctuary. And there was a picture of the carpenter. And all of a sudden, in looking at the picture, I noticed there was no cross. And the thought came into my mind, but where is the cross? And right behind it, another thought. And that thought was this: it's been removed, Tom, and so has yours. I got a little kid at home named Jason. Most beautiful boy on the face of the earth, I don't care what you say. And when Jason was younger, you've heard of armchair philosophers. Well, he was a potty chair philosopher. When he sat on his potty, he wanted somebody to sit there and talk to him and listen to him, and I got the job one day. Listen to your children. My God, they know where it's at. Out of nowhere, my little boy looks up at me and says, "Dad, Jesus turns the power on." I'm not trying to sell you Jesus. This is what he said. I said, "Hey, how'd you know that? Your mama tell you?" He said, "No, sir." "Well, did you learn that in Sunday school?" "No, sir." I said, "Well, how do you know that, son?" He said, "It's simple. I just know. That's why." I thought about this. Why is it when any man, woman, or child, alcoholic or not, reaches that point in his life, that bottom, that point of despair where all the stops are out, and he knows he's dying and there's nothing he can do about it, why is it he'll say the equivalent every time of three words: "God help me"? Because we just know. That's why. We don't have to think about it. Our big book says that faith is a part of our makeup. That deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. And when trouble hits, the words come. No thoughts required. Excuse me. I'm sitting there with Jace a couple of weeks later on the couch. We hug a lot around my house. I'm a hugger. I'll apologize to you for not hugging all of you this weekend, but when I came up, I was coming off the flu. And at my house, it looked like a detox center. Everybody was puking. But we hug a lot, you know, and if one gets a disease, everybody's going to get it. And we're sitting there, and Jace got his arm around me, you know, and he says, "Dad," he says, "why don't I be the father for a while and you be the son?" I said, "How are we going to work that?" He said, "It's easy. I'll grow up and be the father, and you grow down and be the son." Look in your big book, page 62. If you want to make this deal, it says, first of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Hereafter, in this game of life, he's going to be the director. He's the principal. We're the agents. He's the father. We're his children. And it says, most good ideas are simple. And this concept, father-child, was the keystone of the arch through which we passed to what? Sobriety? No. Freedom! And this came from a kid. So very simple. Chris Christopherson wrote a song once about freedom. He said, "Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose." Think about it. When I woke up this morning, I didn't have to think about how to control your life. I didn't think about how to control yours either, Joyce, or the world or anything in it. I didn't even have to think about controlling my own life. Because I got a father. Let me say it again. I have got a father. And he's in control. And I'm free. I ain't got to run this world anymore. And God, that's freedom. So here I stand. I'm Tom Brady, Jr. I'm an alcoholic. I got the same equipment I had when I came here a little over 11 years ago. But I'm not the same. But I'm not the same. What's the difference? Old Baptist hymn, folks. Amazing grace. How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. Grace is the difference. And grace is a gift. It's a gift from a loving father to his children. And for the alcoholic like me, grace is a knowledge of God's will for my life and the power to carry it out. And that grace comes through trying to use these spiritual tools. Every step of this program is important. But if you really want to find freedom, steps 4 through 7 are really important. No place in our book does it say we look for our assets. It says we look for the things that are blocking us. We look for our faults. We look for our liabilities. And we say, oh, that's negative. I have found now through this program that my assets for years were covered by my liabilities. And if I write them down, admit them, and pray for their removal, it's like taking a blanket off a bed and out come the assets. I believe that every one of us is like a diamond in the rough. You pull a diamond out of the mud and it's a mud ball. And you take a fourth step on that diamond and you wash off that mud and immediately it begins to reflect the sunlight. And you put a tenth step on that jewel and you hone it and you polish it and you cut it and it becomes more and more beautiful. Certainly we're beautiful, but only after we uncover the beauty and the God that's in us begins to come out. And he's always been there. Always. In our big book, it says, our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholics and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he were sought. I don't know about you. Not only could he and would he, but he can and he did. And I'm still a perfectionist. Did you know that? But the same perfectionistic drive that drove me toward self-hate and self-destruction has turned, and it's driving me toward a more abundant life. And that same ultra-sensitivity, which was once a defect, enables me now to sit down and listen to you and feel for you and cry for you and pick up vibes when things are right and when things are wrong. Even the intellect helped me. And I'm still a dreamer, and God helped me. I hope I always am. But these things have changed. Defects become assets. Under the power of God. Ain't no two ways about it. He can do anything he wants to. And what he wants for me is a happy, joyous, effective life. I told you about my dad. My dad used to take me out when I was a kid and we did great big things. He taught me how to skip rocks across the water. He always took me to the woods. He always pointed out to me without saying a word just how beautifully everything fits.
Every tree was in its place. We had no money, so my father would make me bows and arrows that were more beautiful than the ones that you could buy in the store. And my father is a decent, good, kind, and gentle man. And I always wanted to be that way. And through the grace of God, folks, this is not arrogance, this is truth. What you're looking at up here today is a decent, good, kind, gentle man. You know why? I'm going to tell you why. In the words of another yo-yo named David, the why is, the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for His name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for Thou art with me, Thy rod and Thy staff, they comfort me. And listen to this one. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Folks, we are surrounded today by our enemies. This world has not changed. There's bars all over the streets out there. Reality has not changed, and I don't want to change it. Because I have learned that freedom is an inside job. I don't have to change reality. I have to change me. He anointeth my head with oil. My cup runneth over. Let me tell you how it runneth over. I got two AA babies. I got one daughter who got here before. And I got another daughter who got here later who is named after an AA lady. And her name is Frances. And she's six. And she's beautiful. She has golden hair. The most beautiful set of lips I've ever seen on any person. And we kiss all the time. And one of my favorite things is pinching her bottom. She's got the prettiest bottom you ever saw. And she'll come up to me and she'll smooch me good and then she'll turn that little tush around to me and say, Dad, you want a pinch? My cup runneth over. And I got that little boy, Jason, who can sit down and say to me, Dad, no matter what you say, no matter what you do, I love you just like you are. You're the best daddy in the whole world. And you're my best friend. And I got a wife who says, Tom, you're not the same person you were when you came to AA. You're not the same person you were even a year ago. You're a better man now than you've ever been. I've been married to three different men, she says, and I love them all. My cup runs over. Surely, goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. And I'll dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Why? Because I'm special? No. Because I have an all-powerful, all-loving Father who wants only the best for me and has given me the most precious gift that any human being has ever received. Freedom from the bondage of self. God bless you, and I love you.